Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Some Nightmares Are Real, The Haunting Truth Behind Alabama's Supernatural Tales by Kelly Kasich, narrated by Courtney Patterson. Introduction. A love for campfire tales, folklore, and ghost stories. An incident from my childhood is etched in my memory in detail, as vivid and jumpy as an 8mm film. It was summer, dark, and the Georgia woods were filled with the sounds of bullfrogs and cicadas. In my mind, like watching a reel from a 1970s vacation to Jekyll Island, I can see my 6-year-old self running up the concrete patio steps from our backyard and banging my tiny fists on the sliding glass doors for my mother to let me in. I was wailing. I was terrified. Earlier that night, my family, Mom, Dad, my older brother, and I, were joined by members of 3 other families for a barbecue in the backyard. By nightfall, we were sitting around a fire pit near the edge of the woods behind our house. The fathers had decided to tell ghost stories. My mom and several others had gone inside to finish clearing the mess from the picnic tables. I was one of the younger children there, with the oldest being 13. One dad, I forget which, began recounting the tale of Rawhead and Bloody Bones. The details of the legend are sketchy in my mind, probably because they were overridden by the terror I felt in the dark of the woods that night. Suffice it to say, the title alone was enough to instill a thudding fear in my young heart and send me rushing from my log seat to the safety of the house. Since then, I have researched the legend to try to recall details of the story. Most of the people who were there that night, including my parents, have died. Others, like me, were too young to remember specifics. My research tells me that portions of the legend of Rawhead and Bloody Bones date to the 1600s in England. In the southern United States, the names refer to 2 creatures who are part of one monster. Rawhead is a skull that bites its victims, and Bloody Bones is the creepy, dancing remains of his skeleton. In one version, Rawhead bites off the head of a person who was spreading gossip, a cautionary tale to those who might circulate unsubstantiated rumors. In the half-century since that night, I have been fascinated with legends and folklore. At some point, my terror turned to curiosity. I can now enjoy a good spooky story around a campfire without fear, although I still feel a creeping sensation on my back, as if eyes in the forest are watching. But what I love even more than a good story is a good story based on factual events. I've never enjoyed those ghost hunting shows in which teams wear night vision goggles or bring equipment to record ghostly voices. My interest is in the tale itself, not in the proving or disproving of it. During my decades as a journalist, I was drawn to outsider art, roadside attractions, quirky history, and ghostly legends. When I wasn't reporting news stories, I was seeking out the weird and whimsical. Eventually, I stopped writing hard news altogether and became what I call a weird news reporter, seeking out the world's largest objects, such as the world's largest Rubik's Cube in Knoxville, Tennessee, or the world's largest ketchup bottle in Collinsville, Illinois, or people who create art from found objects, or hauntings based on an area's very real history. In this book, I wanted to share folklore in the form of ghost stories from Alabama, my home state since I was 12 years old, when I moved to Huntsville from Georgia. In high school, my friends and I enacted all the rituals of teenhood in the 1980s, driving over supposedly haunted bridges, scaring ourselves in cemeteries or searching for ghosts, including the spirits that supposedly haunted the dead children's playground, which is described in this book. That's what folklore is, orally passing down a community's stories or beliefs. Of course, the stories change with the tellings. That is part of the fascination of folklore. But the stories are grounded in truth, in historical places, people, and times. The lore that follows is all based on real places and people in Alabama. I have framed the stories with invented tales, told in the manner in which they might be recounted around a campfire, and created fictional characters who thrill to the folklore in the same way that my friends and I did as kids. A section in the back of this book tells listeners which parts of the stories are real and provides information on places related to the stories that they can actually visit. I tried to avoid legends that had been widely recounted in other books, including Katherine Tucker Wyndham's beloved 13 Ghosts and Jeffrey series. The point of folklore, however, is that it is repeated through generations. In today's world, that means stories that have likely been recorded somewhere on the vast internet, so elements of all of the stories can likely be found online. There are those who believe telling ghost tales is somehow evil or anti-religious. I believe it has a different purpose. Folklore, in many cases, was a way to explain phenomena that was then considered unexplainable, thus the use of supernatural elements, or to provide lessons to frighten people into doing what was considered right or safe, such as not walking alone at night on isolated roads. I hope you will enjoy these tales for what they are, a tribute to the time-honored process of passing lore from one person to another. Once I have told you these stories, you can keep them going by telling them yourself. Perhaps you can visit some of the real places mentioned in this book and learn some history of the great state of Alabama. Most important, I hope you get just scared enough to pull the covers up to your chin. Don't forget to leave the bedside light on. Legend 1. The People Under the Lake.
People used to live down there, you know, under the lake, Jake said, looking over the side of the John boat into the dark water of Weiss Lake.
Ricky, who was often one step behind Jake, mimicking his every action in adoration of the older boy, followed his gaze but saw only his own reflection on the surface. It was impossible to see anything beneath the water. Its normal, deep blue took on an almost purplish hue at its deepest. But Jake continued to try to peer into the depths of the impenetrable surface.
"I've heard some people are still down there."
Ricky's reflected eyes grew big.
"Jake McClellan!" Maggie Bartlett scolded her friend, rolling her eyes. "Stop trying to scare Ricky!" Maggie's little brother was only 12, and their parents had forced her to bring him along. She knew her little brother served as a sort of chaperone. She and Jake weren't allowed to take his folks' fancy ski boat out alone. Not until next year, when they would be seniors in high school. Instead, they'd brought the smaller boat Mr. McClellan used for bass fishing.
"I'm not kidding," Jake insisted, changing direction to angle the boat toward the shore of a small island, where they planned to pull out the cooler and have some drinks and late afternoon snacks on the strip of sand.
The three had spent most of the day on Weiss Lake, and the sun had made the Bartlett siblings' skin glow a deep pink. But not Jake's. He lived with his folks in a house on the lake, and he was on the water any time his parents let him. His skin was a deep golden brown color that reminded Maggie of Grammy's pecan pie.
"People really did live down there before the 1950s, Jake continued. "There were farms and churches and cemeteries and all kinds of things that now sit on the bottom, 50, 60 feet beneath our boat. There are people still down there, or at least their bodies."
Ricky shivered and Maggie gave Jake a warning look.
"Bodies?" Ricky squeaked. "Are there really bodies down there?"
As Jake neared the island, he stopped the motor and hopped out of the boat into the shallow water so he could pull the small craft to the sandy beach. When the boat dragged on the sandy bottom, he motioned for the others to hop out. Maggie stepped into the water and noticed Ricky had paused to look into the water, which now only came up as high as his knees. Jake neatly pulled the empty boat far enough onto the sand to secure it.
"Yes, bodies. They didn't always move the bodies in the cemeteries before they flooded the land, before they made the lake."
"What do you mean, before they made the lake? Doesn't nature kind of make the lakes?"
Ricky looked up from the water, pushing his glasses back on his sun-reddened nose.
It was probably going to peel, along with the sliver of his shoulder not covered by the life jacket, Maggie thought. Her mother would blame her for not making her brother put on sunscreen.
"No, squirt," Jake said, pulling the bulky cooler from the bottom of the boat. "Lots of lakes are man-made. In Alabama, all of the big lakes are artificial. People would just decide they needed lakes in certain areas and then dam the water and control the flow to create power.
It's all about the simoleons,
Jake said, rubbing his fingers together as if holding money.
Haven't you taken social studies class?
Ricky shook his head. Alabama history was taught to all fourth grade classes in public school, but Ricky had not learned about the lakes in his class 2 years before. Suddenly, Ricky let out a shriek and splashed the last few feet toward the beach.
What is it?
Maggie said with a squawk of her own, automatically moving inland, just in case he had encountered some sort of underwater creepy crawly. Ricky limped to a large fallen log next to an old fire pit, left by countless teens before them. He shook his head.
I don't know, he said. All of a sudden, the ground seemed to give way beneath my foot and it twisted a little. For a minute, it felt like I was being sucked down.
Sit down and let me look,
Maggie demanded in the motherly tone she used with Ricky whenever Mom wasn't around. The ankle was slightly red, but otherwise unblemished.
Looks okay to me, she said. Maybe you just stepped in a hole.
Jake's grin looked a little too self-satisfied for Maggie's taste. That typically meant he was up to one of his pranks. She loved him, but he sure could be exasperating.
Jake, she said in a warning tone, what did you do?
Me? I didn't do anything, he said. I just know what it was he stepped in.
Maggie's and Ricky's heads turned toward Jake at the same time and angle, like a couple of meerkats who spotted food.
You do?
Ricky asked. Jake nodded.
It was a grave,
he said, lowering his voice ominously.
Stop it, Jake,
Maggie commanded. She hated when he tried to scare Ricky.
I'm telling the truth, he said, and I can prove it. Come, stand right here.
Jake stood with his toes touching the lapping lake and pointed straight ahead with Ricky and Maggie standing cautiously behind him.
See how low the water is here? And how we could just walk the boat onto the beach? That's because we've been in a drought for 2 months and the water is low. It's the only time you can really see them.
I don't see anything, Ricky said.
Come over here where the sun isn't hitting the water.
It was shallow enough that the kids could have walked 20 or 30 feet without even getting their knees wet. The lake water was nice and clear in this shallow pool. Jake pointed.
See right there?
I only see some dark spots in the dirt under the water, Ricky said with a shrug.
Yeah, and what shape are they?
Jake asked. Ricky looked more closely.
Rectangles, he said. I see dark rectangles in the sand beneath the water.
Ricky looked to Jake for confirmation.
Yep. And what kinds of things are rectangular?
Ricky looked back and noticed the rectangles were all human-sized and were perfectly lined up beneath the clear water.
Graves, Maggie said in a heavy voice.
Graves.
You just had us walking through graves.
She punched Jake in the arm as her annoyance rose.
What if what Ricky stepped on was someone's body?
Ricky shuddered. Jake shrugged.
The official story is there are no bodies here. But that's not what I think, he said. This used to be Lawrence Cemetery, and the power company claims it moved the bodies before flooding the area in the 1960s.
Ricky pushed his glasses back on his nose.
So you weren't making that up before? About flooding towns to build power dams?
Nope, Jake said. That's why I brought you here. You can only see this when there's a pretty severe drought and the lake levels are much lower than normal. Want to hear the story?
The sun had begun its low descent. Maggie was feeling a bit creeped out herself, but Ricky nodded vigorously, caught in the spell of Jake's tale.
We really should go so we can get back across the lake before dark, Maggie said.
She glanced nervously at the lowering sun.
We have plenty of time, Jake said, glancing up. The story is not very long. If y'all sit down and listen, we'll head straight back to my house afterward.
Yeah, come on, Mags, Ricky said excitedly. I want to hear.
He turned to Jake.
How do you know so much, anyway?
Jake smiled.
I've lived on this lake my whole life, he said. I hear stuff. Plus, I did my sophomore project on how all the major lakes in Alabama were made, including this one. I called it Drowned Towns. Only A I ever earned.
Okay, Maggie said grudgingly.
She wouldn't admit it,
but now she was interested too. "But make it quick, okay?"
Jake pulled a bottle of Sundrop from the cooler, cozied up to the long-dead coals from previous fires, and said, "Just settle around the fire pit, grab a Coke, and listen." Some of the old-timers say on quiet nights, boaters have heard the ghostly chimes of church bells rising from beneath Weiss Lake. Sometimes, the eerie baying of unseen coonhounds will echo across the water, said to be the spirits of hunting dogs whose graves were never moved before the dam was built and the farmlands flooded. Still, others have reported seeing ghostly figures appearing atop the water, hovering, trying to find their homes. At least, that's what legends say. Lots of small communities were submerged beneath Alabama's man-made lakes from the 1910s through the 1960s by the state's big power companies, Alabama Power Company and the Tennessee Valley Authority. Building dams not only created electricity in rural areas and jobs in the wake of the Great Depression and World War II, the projects also created recreational areas where people could boat and fish and water ski. The waterways brought tourists to the state.
"So these big companies say they moved the towns before they were flooded, and mostly they did. Bought the houses and churches and schools and tore them down," Jake explained. "I mean, it makes sense, right? They couldn't leave a church with a steeple so high it would catch the bottom of a boat. They wouldn't leave a valuable house just for fish to swim through."
He continued his story. To create all those lakes in Alabama, the power companies had to move thousands of people, living and dead, to land outside the flood zones. First, dams were built in nearby rivers, then engineers surveyed and determined what the pool level was going to be and which homes would be impacted by the reservoir. Then power company representatives headed out with their checkbooks, offering people, usually, a fair market price for homes and land.
"On some farms, smaller outbuildings like small barns and sheds were left behind," Jake said. "What was surprising was how many big old homes, mansions even, were left beneath the lake. Some of the well-off folks paid to have their nice homes hooked up to trailers and moved to higher land. I saw an old black-and-white photo of a big old mansion called Snow Hill being moved along a dirt road to higher ground. But lots were torn down, and some were nearly 100 years old."
"So what about the dead people?"
Ricky pressed for a definitive answer, wanting to know, and not wanting to, if he'd actually stepped in a grave. He pointed to the rectangles, their shadows deepening beneath the shallow surface as the sun lowered.
"Are there still some under here?"
Jake shrugged.
"Depends on who you believe.
When I was researching my project, I found actual cemetery relocation forms used by some power companies when they were creating the lakes. They went to surviving family members and offered to move the bodies to cemeteries that would be above water so their folks could still visit them. They would just dig them up and move the caskets and the headstones to another graveyard. The problem was, some of the graves had been there since the 1800s, and there were no family members around anymore. There was no one to visit the graves, so no reason to move the bodies. No one really knows what happened to those remains. But most locals think the bodies are still down there."
The kids were hushed, except for the sound of Jake crunching on some Doritos, while they thought about the bodies potentially buried a few feet away.
"That's creepy,"
Ricky said, trying to keep the tremor from his voice. He grabbed the Doritos from Jake and chewed nervously and noisily.
"What's creepy is what some of the old folks told me for my project. I went over to Valley View Nursing Home, like my teacher suggested, and talked to some people there. Old Mr. Huey, remember him? He used to own the bait shop. He told me one of the creepiest tales I'd ever heard."
Ricky and Mags didn't speak, which Jake took as a green light to resume his storytelling.
"He was out in his bass boat one night with Mrs. Huey. It was getting dark, and Mrs. H was pressing Mr. H to get back to the house before it got too dark to see the dock. So Mr. H tells me, he said,"
Jake changed his voice to a deeper, more southern tone to imitate Mr. Huey, and continued,
"The missus just kept jawing and nagging at me till I finally accused her of being a scart. 'I am scart,' she says.
I've heard the stories just like you have about the bodies under the lake that come out at night to walk on the water, the spirits of people looking for their lost homes. Mr. H. told his wife that, of course, that was a lot of claptrap, but he packed up his gear anyway and was about to start the motor to head to shore. That's when they heard it, the sound of church bells that seemed to rise up from under the lake and ripple in echoes outward, according to Mr. H.
Mrs. Hooey looked terrified. "See, I told you," she said nervously. "Let's get out of here."
Mr. H. pulled the engine cord, but it only sputtered. Before he could pull again, he looked at Mrs. Hooey and saw her eyes were as big around as cathead biscuits. He followed her gaze and saw the clear but shimmery form of a man in old-timey clothes, like a farmer's Sunday suit. The apparition walked on top of the surface of the lake, but it continued looking down, worried, with a hat in his hands, like he was trying to see something beneath the surface. Jake continued in a dramatic fashion. Mr. Hooey pulled the cord again, and the motor sprang to life. He gave it a bit too much gas in his hurry to get out of there, and it lurched forward. When he finally looked back, the figure was gone. He told me Mrs. H. didn't say a word all the way home. She was never the same after that, and she would never go on the lake again.
"Okay, that's enough," Mag said, standing and gathering their empties to stash in the cooler. By then, the sky had changed from pinks and oranges to a deepening purple. "I'm ready to go. Now!" She could tell by his face that Ricky was truly afraid, and she realized they were going to have to walk past the underwater graves again to get the boat off the beach. Jake noticed her apprehension.
"Don't worry," he said, realizing he may have pushed too far. "Y'all can hop in here on the beach, and I can use the oars to push us until the water is deep enough to run the motor."
Mags's breath released in a whoosh. After they'd gathered their snacks and trash, she helped Ricky into the John boat, then she climbed in herself. Jake walked the boat out, struggling a little with their added weight, until the water reached his knees, seemingly unconcerned about the dark rectangles in the dirt. Just as Jake was about to hop in and row to deeper water, he lurched as if something had grabbed him. He tried jumping in the boat again, but splashed back to the water.
"What is it? Get in! We need to leave!"
Mag said, her voice sounding urgent now.
"I'm trying," Jake said, sounding mystified. "Something is pulling my ankle."
"You stop joking right this minute and get in the boat,"
Mag said in her most determined and stern mother's voice.
"I'm not joking. Something has my left leg,"
Jake said. Now even he sounded frightened. Finally, he managed to heave himself into the boat, pulling the left leg as hard as he could from the bottom of the lake. Maggie grabbed an oar to help row, and they pushed through the water as fast as they could. After rowing for 30 or 40 yards, they set down the oars, and Jake prepared to start the small motor. Just as his hand reached the pull cord, they heard the deep clang of a bell ring out. But it sounded muffled, as if its clapper was wrapped in cotton.
"Hurry, Jake!"
Maggie cried.
"Yes, I want to go home,"
Ricky cried plaintively. Just before the sound of the bell faded, Ricky saw, in the fading light, the figure of a man wearing a suit and hat from the old days, like the 1920s or 30s. The figure seemed to walk on top of the water, looking down as if searching for something beneath the surface. Ricky pointed a shaky finger, and the other's gaze followed its direction.
"What the?"
Jake said. Maggie, who hadn't believed in ghosts that morning, shuddered.
"Please hurry,"
she whispered as the figure of the man shimmered in front of them, starting to come apart like a cloud on a windy day, an arm floating away here and a leg fading away there. Finally, the figure was nothing but a mist. Jake gave another hard tug, and the engine burped and sputtered before settling into a smooth hum. The boat shot across the lake. When Jake looked back where the apparition had been, he saw nothing. When they finally reached the McClellan's dock, Maggie was really worried about Ricky. He hadn't said a word since they saw the strange figure.
"Are you okay, Ricky?"
He nodded, but looked pale.
"Please don't tell Mom and Dad. They'll never let us go anywhere with Jake again,"
Maggie pleaded. Ricky merely stared back across the lake to where the figure had been. He didn't acknowledge his sister's plea.
"Help me get him on the dock, would you?"
she asked Jake, pulling Ricky to his feet.
Sure,
Jake said, climbing out and tying off the boat. As he held his hands down to help Ricky pull to the dock, Mags saw Jake's ankle.
Jake, she cried. What is that?
His ankle was red and swollen.
It's nothing,
he said, pulling Ricky onto the plank platform and shrugging aside Maggie's concerns.
It probably just got tangled in some water hyacinth.
It wasn't water hyacinth,
Ricky said in a small and wooden voice.
What?
How do you know? Jake asked. Ricky pointed at his own ankle, the one that had sunk into the sand where the graves were located. Mags looked closely and could see a red mark encircling his ankle and small bruises the size of the pads of fingers, as if he had been grabbed by a hand. Maggie looked back at Jake's foot. There, she saw the same thing. Fingerprints around his ankle. She shuddered.
Come on, let's get inside, she said, hopping out onto the dock.
As she and Jake helped Ricky up the stairs toward the yard, Maggie glanced back at the water and thought she noticed something else. She hoped, she prayed she was wrong. There, just beneath the surface, a human-shaped shadow moved down toward the murky depths. Legend 2. The Dead Children's Playground.
I am not going in there at night, Beck said, shaking her strawberry blonde curls for emphasis. I don't care what you say, not only because of the ghosts, but because the park is closed after dark, and I've heard the police drive by there all the time. I'm not going to get in trouble for some silly ghost hunt.
You're just scared, Max said with a laugh.
Of course she is, Rhonda responded. Anyone who has ever heard of the Dead Children's Playground is scared of it. I mean, it's called Dead Children's Playground, for Jiminy's sake. Just saying the words together gives me goosebumps. I'm with Bex on this one.
What if we go during the day? Clay said.
Max made a face of disgust. Going during the daytime didn't require any real bravery. The Dead Children's Playground was a very real park in Huntsville that just happened to adjoin one of the largest and oldest burial grounds in the state, Maple Hill Cemetery. The geography of the location only added to its aura of mystery. It was set in a natural alcove closed on three sides by rock walls so that the park was often in shadow, even on the brightest summer day. On that day, in early August, the weather was expected to be scorching, but Max and Clay were determined not to let their last few days of summer before their senior year go to waste. Bex looked doubtful, but Rhonda said,
Come on, Bex. All kinds of parents and kids, alive ones, go there during the day. It'll be fine. We'll show the boys there's nothing there and be done with it. They did go shopping with us last week for new school clothes.
Bex considered a moment.
Fine, she said. But I still think it's stupid.
Clay hollered, Shotgun! And raced to the car, but Bex put her hands on her hips and stood silently, letting him and Max know that she was riding in the front passenger seat. Max knew he couldn't afford to make his girlfriend any angrier with him.
Come on, Clay, you know Bex is riding up front with me, he said.
Clay hopped in back beside Rhonda, whom he kinda sorta dated from time to time, just because the four of them were always together. Really, Clay and Rhonda were more friends than love interests. Max turned the radio up high, and that, combined with the rush of the wind from the windows, meant there was no use trying to hold a conversation as they drove. Instead, Bex thought back to what she knew about the Dead Children's Playground. There was one story she knew better than the others, mainly because her mother had told it to her. It was the story of her great-grandmother, Grace Swanner. It was October 1918, and Grace's family had just gotten word her big brother Ellis would be coming home from the Great War in a military casket. The fighting was over, and he had survived the battles, but another enemy had arrived, and this enemy didn't choose allegiances. It killed nearly everyone in its path. It was the Spanish influenza, or what the old folks sometimes called the grip, and it was killing people in all parts of the world. Some people wondered if the epidemic was God's punishment for the horrible deeds carried out in a war that had affected the entire world. Grace, who had just turned 11, didn't know if the flu was God's retribution but she did know her world had changed overnight. The announcement came in the newspaper the day after her birthday on September 28th. The Spanish flu had arrived in Huntsville. And now, only 3 weeks later, the once bustling...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?